Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the first segment of the program today, democracy needs journalism. How and why we read the news. We'll be rejoined by Dr. Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News. We'll talk about a fake news detection kit. We'll apply critical media literacy to the election season. Later in the program, we look at free speech issues on campus. We're joined by Vice President of Communications for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. What's the climate for free speech on America's college campuses? Their recent study looked at 20,000 students on 55 campuses to assess how free speech and expression are faring on today's college campuses. Today on the Project Censored Show, an hour dedicated to the free press and free speech. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment, we welcome back to the program critical media literacy scholar and historian, Dr. Nolan Higdon. His most recent book from UC Press is The Anatomy of Fake News, a Critical News Literacy Education. Nolan Higdon also co-authored with me for City Lights books, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. And also, he is a longtime contributor to Project Censored's annual publications and websites, has a new piece up on the Censored Notebook. And today, we're going to be talking about a new presentation that Nolan is giving at campuses around the country. Democracy needs journalism, how and why we read the news. And Dr. Nolan Higdon, we welcome you back to the program as we are in the midst of a very contentious election year, and critical media literacy education is a crucial component of how we act in our democratic republic. And of course, that's partially what fueled your creation of this presentation. Obviously, we aren't sharing the whole presentation and visuals on the radio, but you are going to walk us through this media literacy primer and relate it to what we need to know about in order to be more informed and better informed about the upcoming election in November here in the U.S. Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me, Mickey.
Always a pleasure, and you certainly always have much to share with all of our listeners. So based on your last book with UC Press on the anatomy of fake news, you've put together this presentation on how democracy needs journalism and how and why we read the news. And this follows some of the material that you have in your book on the anatomy of fake news, in particular, the final chapter, which is your fake news detection kit and 10-point process to save our democracy. But let's get started here. What's prompting you to put this together? Give our listeners a little overview.
I get a sense that we've lost the connection between journalism and democracy. And as a people here in the United States, I think we've even lost sort of our emphasis on democracy, at least in my estimation. There seems to be a post-Cold War sentiment that the Cold War was fought between capitalism and communism, and we need to make everything sort of market-driven, including our schools. But if you go back during the Cold War, at least rhetorically, the United States claimed it was a war between democracy and communism, and they tried to emphasize democracy rhetorically. But we've lost that in the last 30 or 40 years. And so I think a lot of people forget the reason we have democracy and why we used to have our institutions focused on democracy. And one of those institutions, of course, is the press, which is essential to a democracy, the so-called fourth estate or essential pillar of democracy. And so I wanted to bring this talk to say that we need to, one, protect our democracy, which is under threat from multiple actors and institutions. And then we also need to revitalize journalism and use it in a way that strengthens democracy rather than the way we have been using it, which seems to be a feed partisan divides and entertain ourselves, share headlines. That's not why we read the news.
We want to read the news to be informed. We want to make intelligent, informed, fact-based decisions, whether we're voting or supporting propositions or just communicating with our neighbors. You and I documented in United States of Distraction this cultural decline in terms of information currency and how we share information and how social media has impacted that. But going back further, it's also the case that we've been a democratic state, from your arguments, in decline. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about some of these signposts along the way that have been warning people about these developments?
There's a deep history there, especially in the late 70s and early 80s, of transferring power from institutions that represented the people, such as unions, to institutions run by the elite without democratic oversight, like the Federal Reserve and such. As you mentioned, a lot of people warned on the way about this. You know, you can think of Chris Hedges or Morris Berman, Neil Postman. These types of folks were warning about this at the end of the 20th century and early 21st century. And then, of course, Chalmers Johnson.
Numerous people from Ben Bagdikian to Carl Jensen, the work at Project Censored, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, as far as it relates to media. Also, the Democracy Index and some of the work that you've done. And, of course, the studies at Northwestern and Princeton that say the U.S. is an oligarchy run by plutocrats. 100 million people don't even vote. Talk a little bit about some of those signposts.
All of those warnings had taken place. But then when Trump was electored to the White House, that seems to be, like, as you said, when liberals woke up to the idea that their democracy was in trouble. And my real critique with that is, I'm no defender of Trump, but it has led to this fixation on Trump, that somehow if Donald Trump is removed from office, our democracy will be strengthened and everything will go back to normal. And it's important to point out, during the Obama and Clinton years, democracy was being emaciated just as much as Reagan and the two Bush eras. Trump is simply just the latest symptom of this problem. And you talk about the oligarchy. Gillins and Page said in 2014 that basically the super wealthy in this country get what they want 90% of the time in terms of policy. Poor people almost never get what they want unless their interests happen to align with the super wealthy. And that's a sign of an oligarchy. Furthermore, democracies are predicated on participation. We have 100 million people, according to a Knight study that came out this year, that don't vote. And they're disproportionately poor and people of color. So I know there's this MSNBC talking point that it comes with privilege not to vote. But these are some of the most underprivileged people in the country, and they simply do not have a reason to vote. Neither of these candidates are giving them policy or options to turn out and vote. And it's not like they're hiding this. I mean, Joe Biden has basically said, and his campaign has said, we are trying to get white Republican suburban voters. So they're going after this unicorn voter, which is the white Republican who wants to vote Democrat, and ignoring these 100 million people who are desperate. Yeah, so that's, I mean, you know, that's kind of what I mean about a democracy in trouble. And I know there's all this rhetoric of, if Trump wins in 2020, our democracy is over. No, like, our democracy is over either way, unless we dramatically change things. And this idea that Trump represents the end of democracy, if that's true, he's already in power. So the democracy would already be over. It's this really fear-based argument that comes really ignorant of the history pre-Trump, so we don't contextualize sort of what Trump has done. And that's my fear, is people are going to the ballot box with a very skewed understanding of the reality about American democracy.
Well, you talk about the 100 million people not voting being disproportionately poor and people of color, according to the 2020 Knight Foundation study. As Jim Hightower quipped at one point, if the gods had wanted us to vote, they would have given us candidates. You cite the Democracy Index as well, and the United States actually ranks 25th in the world. And so you say that rather than it being a full democracy, it's rather a flawed one. And of course, you then go on to talk about, well, what is the connection between the vibrancy and the health of our democratic institutions and the Fourth Estate, or the so-called free press?
We can't overstate that democracies are predicated on the press. So you can look at what's going on right now in Louisville, for example, with Breonna Taylor. A lot of people have strong opinions about what happened in that case and what happened in the protests afterward. But the majority of those people have never been to Louisville. They've never met Breonna Taylor. They've never met her family. They've never met the police. They've never seen the grand jury. They know everything they know from the press. That's the power of the press. They can turn us on to things, wake us up to things. They really have an unmatched power influencing our perspective. It's the only job that has a constitutional protection. News is very important, and we spend a lot of time critiquing problems in news media, but we also spend a lot of time lauding great news media. I mean, you can't deny things like Ronan Farrow's reporting on Harvey Weinstein. I mean, that's an amazing job that sort of transformed the public imagination. So reporters do good things, and journalists produce great content that can really strengthen our democracy. And these journalists are out there. But the problem is that finding them can be difficult because they're surrounded by so many journalists who are doing horrible work. And the average citizen really struggles to determine what is good for their news diet.
And at Project Censored, we not only criticize the corporate press and establishment press, but we highlight those very intrepid independent reporters that are doing stellar, transparently sourced, fact-based reporting about issues that truly matter. A major case for journalism, the future of journalism happening right now in the UK with Julian Assange, has gotten almost no coverage by the corporate press. We covered that recently on the Project Censored show with Kevin Gostola, Shadowproof.com, and the folks over at Consortium News. But when I spoke with Kevin Gostola recently, he said that the New York Times and the Washington Post weren't even bothering to send people over to cover the trial or deal with the trial. They were just going to write it up after it was over.
And that's why I think it's really important for listeners to consider turning off a lot of this stuff or removing it from their news diet. And I'm talking about the 24-hour broadcast news networks, major papers, op-ed sections, and things like that. They really do poison people's thinking in a lot of ways. They've branded themselves as the resistance. You know, they're fighting for democracy by bringing the people good journalism. But in reality, they're just kind of lampooning Donald Trump like The Daily Show used to do to Bush decades ago. And we're not really getting discussions about policy and things like that. Like, I know everybody woke up to the courts now that RBG has passed away, but Donald Trump and the Republicans have been stuffing the courts since he took office. And in fact, the morning she died, Mitch McConnell was stuffing the courts. Like, that'd be more important to report on than what Trump has stuck to his foot when he gets off Air Force One or what tweet he did this morning. Like, those are the things that are going to matter to people's lives. And so those are kind of the things I'm concerned about with our news diet. Is you start watching that resistance stuff, you start to believe it. But if these are really people who believed that journalism was a tool of resistance and democracy, maybe if they're defending Julian Assange. If Julian Assange is guilty, this is a huge precedent. This means that the government can not only go after whistleblowers for releasing classified information, but institutions, i.e. the press, for releasing it as well, because they're going to go after WikiLeaks for releasing classified information. And WikiLeaks is a press outlet, whether people want to admit it or not. And this sets a bad precedent for a lot of the rest of news media. So if they really cared about journalism, I think they'd be covering this and defending Assange, whether or not they like him personally or his politics.
Well, as Trevor Timms said at the Press Freedom Foundation, who testified at the Assange trial along with Dan Ellsberg and many other luminaries in the whistleblower world and free press supporting world, the people were coming out in support of Assange. Assange and WikiLeaks was, Tim called them pioneers in what led them to create something called SecureDrop. And over 70 major establishment news organizations around the world, including places like the New York Times, have actually used this SecureDrop for leaked information. So what's fascinating then is, on one hand, and this is the same way that these major news outlets dealt with Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, they were all finger-wagging and accusing them of being traitors on one end of the spectrum, and on the other, they were still using the leaked data to write award-winning journalism. So there's a great sense of hypocrisy amongst the establishment in terms of how they define journalism when it suits them.
And they basically go after these people, at least it appears like it. They go after these people because they're doing their job better than them. The release of the Democratic Party emails, all the reporting covered what wasn't in there, right? How it led to these baseless scandals like Pizzagate and stuff. But what was in there was really interesting. I mean, these were folks who someone did like GPS on them, and they hung out at places like Martha's Vineyard in San Francisco, well-rich places, and never really went to poor areas of the country when they were reading and sending these emails. That's like really good reporting that paints a picture of who leads that party, what this party is saying, how it tried to fix the primary. That's stuff that a democracy needs to know. But instead, these liberal-leaning journalists have turned off Assange because they're too afraid that he was responsible somehow for costing Hillary Clinton the election.
I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. For speaking with media scholar and historian Dr. Nolan Higdon, his latest book from UC Press is The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education. We're talking about how democracy needs journalism. And after this brief break, we're going to talk about what news is, or at least what we think it should be. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In today's program. This segment, we welcome back Dr. Nolan Higdon. He is a media studies scholar and historian. He teaches at California State University, East Bay, Diablo Valley College, and other places. He is also co-host of the Along the Line podcast, sits on the board of the Action Coalition for Media Education. You can learn more about the podcast at projectcensored.org. Along the Line, that's the podcast he hosts with Dr. Nick Baham III. Nolan Higdon, we're talking today about why democracy needs journalism. And before the break, we were talking about many challenges that we face. But you also, in your work, talk about what news actually is. And specifically, you define it through five different characteristics. Can you talk about those?
The role of the news media in a democracy is it's supposed to be a marketplace of ideas, which is critical for democracy to see what ideas are out there. The second function is they're an agenda setter. The press has a unique power to determine what stories we should and shouldn't be paying attention to. So they set the agenda for what the public cares about in that sense. And their third function is they are a watchdog for democracy. They're supposed to shine light on corruption, and they're supposed to hold the powerful accountable. And that way we know if our leaders are doing what they say they're going to do, and that can help us understand how to vote. Their fourth function is an information disseminator. The press needs to deliver the information that we need to be an active player in our democracy. It helps us decide to vote, not vote, protest, not protest, agitate, peacefully assemble. We use the information they provide to decide. And then the fifth function is they're a public mobilizer. They tell the public, you know, what action may or may not work, where our attention should be drawn, what we should be watching, et cetera. So they have a lot of really important functions that enable our democracy to work properly.
So when we're talking about what news is, you also talk about criteria that should be connected to what makes something newsworthy. You talk about five other things there. Of course, big questions that we learn in critical thinking classes, the who, what, why, how, when, where kind of questions. But you also lay out what makes something newsworthy.
Is it new? Is it unusual? Is it interesting? Is it significant? And is it about people? And if the answer is yes to all of those, then that's a story worth reporting. So as a news user, it's good to do the reverse. The stories you're reading, are they new? Are they unusual? Are they interesting? Are they significant? Are they about people?
And also another guiding principle for what is news includes the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, the Ethical Journalism Network, as you've talked about them, and they actually have, again, five pillars. SPJ has four, Ethical Journalism Network has five. What are these key issues that we should be looking for in what is news?
Every news outlet has its own code of ethics. I believe the New York Times still has like the biggest, and that's probably why a lot of its writers haven't read it. The code of ethics in generally like five pillars are journalists are supposed to strive for truth and accuracy. That is, they should want to know what is true and try to be as accurate as possible. They want to practice independence. That is, they want to be free of any conflicting interests they may have, economic interests, political interests, etc. They want to be fair and impartial. So if they report on a particular position or person or institution, they want to get counter views into that news as well. They also have a commitment to humanity that they really need to consider if their reporting is going to cause any harm. And if so, they need to rethink or correct their reporting. And then finally, accountability. Journalists are supposedly accountable to each other. This one, I think, is most interesting. Coming in the mid-20th century, there was a lot of regulation coming out of the post-New Deal and the Great Society. And journalists were very concerned that they would be under government regulation. So they promised as an industry to practice industry regulation by being accountable to each other. And so journalists, they're so well protected, which again is a great thing for democracy, but they have very little accountability as it seems in the present, evidenced by the faulty reporting. Some of the decisions they get away with, like The Washington Post releasing op-eds from anonymous people and things like that, you know, that's stuff that would just never have been allowed like 30 or 40 years ago. So the accountability question, I think the industry is going through kind of a transformative period about how they can be accountable to each other.
Well, speaking of accountability, Nolan Higdon, fake news is nothing new. It's propaganda, disinformation, misinformation. And of course, as people, we seem to be really taken in by titillating stories that turn out to be false. All the way back to 1710, Jonathan Swift wrote, "Falsehood flies and truth comes limping after." That's probably truer now in the social media universe of Twitter and Facebook and so forth. And of course, there have been numerous studies done in the last several years, including by MIT, that show how fast false information seems to proliferate globally in our current digital information systems. But you also, in your work, talk about what is fake news. It's not new. When we use these phrases academically and analytically or critically, can you talk to our listeners about what are some of the main tenets of fake news? And then, of course, you just mentioned accountability. So let's talk about the lack of accountability among some very major journalistic players, from Brian Williams to Bill O'Reilly, Jason Blair.
I have a pretty broad definition. I think it's any false or misleading content that's presented as legitimate news. I didn't believe we could actually address the problem of fake news unless we had a comprehensive understanding. We couldn't pick out individual actors we don't like and then let the people we do like get away with proliferating fake news. So that's why I have this broad definition. Fake news has been around basically for human history because it comes in spoken form as well. And the people who create or institutions who create fake news include self-interested actors. These are people who may want to make a profit online, like a Drudge or Alex Jones. It might be just people who want to entertain themselves, like with April Fool's pranks and stuff like that. State-sponsored propaganda machines will create fake news to propagandize their own people, to manufacture consent and control the population. Satirists will create like fake news programs like Daily Show or publications like The Onion, which look like news, but they're really satire. Nation states, that is people outside of your border, are lobbying fake news. Right now there's a giant information war where countries like Iran, Russia, the United States, China, and others are weaponizing information as a way to influence populations. And I know this will shock listeners. Politicians lie. Political party apparatuses, they create fake news through like PR firms. And then, of course, the traditional press. This gets lost in the Trump era. These really problematic documentaries like After Truth, which was made in concert with CNN, Brian Stelter. But we've had people like, you know, Stephen Glass, who wrote fake news stories for the New Republic for 3 years that were anti-liberal and racist. Jason Blair, who worked for the Times, the Globe, and the Post. And then 24-hour news, you have like Brian Williams and Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly, you know, lied and said he was present for fighting during the Falklands War. And Brian Williams lied about getting hit by an RPG in a helicopter. But there's all those different actors. I looked at kind of the themes, just some general themes. And fake news usually has appeals to nationalism, but usually tries to engender fear and engender hate. And oftentimes it has something about celebrity. Celebrity gossip is usually tied to fake news. And this goes back centuries. Like even Annie Oakley was a main figure in parts of fake news and things like that. So those were the themes I saw reoccurring with fake news.
Not just the themes, but you also go on to talk about how fake news and propaganda are effective, which is why they're employed with regularity.
The 2003 invasion of Iraq is a prime example of how effective fake news can be. You were able to convince the population that weapons of mass destruction existed that don't. And, you know, in the internet age, this has just gotten worse. You know, fake news is 70% more likely to spread than truth on the internet. Things like bots help amplify it. I hate to be the alarmist about new technology, but I do think there is a legitimate reason to be alarmed about the internet. I think it has a dynamic that other media have not had. Its ability to collect data and create profiles of users and then customize content based on that profile to appeal to people's emotions in ways that people don't understand is a really powerful tool. It's basically these algorithms are saying that they can document your life patterns and off of that predict what you would do if you came into contact with certain content. This is twofold. This happens from users who customize their own environments online. We block out what information we don't want and we keep what information we do want. And studies show we like to be confirmed in our views. So we like to keep in content that we agree with and we like to block out content we disagree with. The algorithms do this as well because they want to keep you on your screen clicking. So they customize your search results and news feeds to confirm your beliefs rather than challenge them. And we have people just living in like completely different universes. When I did this study, you can step into other people's thought bubble and they just have a totally different world, maybe built on absolute falsehoods, but they believe it to their core. And studies show that the more people hear something through repetition, the more likely they are to believe it. And even when they're presented with irrefutable information disproving it, they still will hold on to the falsehood.
I certainly encourage people to read your latest book on the anatomy of fake news, A Critical News Literacy Education. Some of this information also in the latest documentary we put together for Project Censored that's available for free, by the way. The documentary is called United States of Distraction, Fighting the Fake News Invasion, where we also talk about these many issues. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. Again, that's a free documentary. But let's wrap up the last few minutes we have left in this segment with the detection or deconstructing the news. How do we detect fake news and how do we deconstruct the news? What are some of the key steps that you outline that comes from your research, Nolan Higdon?
One thing that Allison Butler of the Action Coalition for Media Education said, and I think this still reigns true, is we really need to recast ourselves as media citizens. So when you sit down at your computer or you pop open your paper or you're watching TV, remind yourself that you're there for the purpose of serving democracy. So if what you're using is not serving democracy, turn it off or choose something else. And it's something that you're not going to deconstruct or analyze or question. Don't go out and share it vocally. Don't write emails about it. Don't share it on social media, because then you become part of the fake news problem. We really need to take our job in a democracy more seriously. So I think recasting ourselves as a media citizen is a good start. And closely follow up with that. When you encounter what you think is news content, don't just react to it. Like, don't say, oh, great, this finally, I can own the libs or whatever it is. Investigate it. Investigate what it is. Fake news is really good at appealing to your reactive emotions. Like, instead, you need to slow down and think about the content. This process can begin simply with just asking yourself, why was my attention drawn to this content in the first place? Now, what personal biases do I have? Did I click on this link versus others because I really wanted to read something bad about Joe Biden? Did I turn on Fox News because I love Trump? What is it that's drawing you? What personal bias is it that makes you choose the media you choose? Can be a crucial question in understanding your own blind spots.
And of course, deconstructing the news by asking critical media literacy-driven questions about the publisher, source. In the recent piece you published at the Censored Notebook at projectcensored.org, you actually did a deep dive behind the scenes of a New York Post article, but it was an exercise in how headlines don't necessarily match the contents of the articles and, well, what's left out of these kinds of titillating kind of articles. So when you talk about deconstructing news, you also talk about asking the right kinds of questions that lead people to, well, why does someone want me to know this? And where did this content come from? And was it vetted? And if so, by whom?
Exactly. You want to know, like, who is the publisher? Who is the author? You want to also make sure you understand the story. Even if the story is wrong, do you understand what they're saying and how they're claiming they prove it? And then you want to look at their sources. Do they have a balance of different viewpoints? Multiple sources or a singular one? Are their sources anonymous? Be very wary of anonymous sourcing, particularly government propagandists like the anonymous sources. And then, you know, does the evidence hold up under scrutiny? Consider what is missing from the content as well. Like you just said, you can do that by comparing it to other news outlets. So if it's a left outlet, look at a right outlet. If it's a corporate outlet, look at an independent outlet covering the same story. And then consider the harm, too. Who might be harmed by the message? Sometimes those of us with privilege might be blind to the ways in which certain news stories could hurt vulnerable populations. So considering the racial and gendered and sexual and ableist implications of a story can get us a more well-rounded understanding of the potential harm of a story. And then, of course, the most basic question you can always ask is, does this qualify as legitimate journalism? Are they serving one of those five functions of a democratic press? Are they fulfilling the criteria to be newsworthy? And are they following the ethics of journalism? So it's a lot of things you need to consider. And so I returned it to Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored, who said, it's really about quality over quantity. Don't try and share as many news articles as possible in a day. Instead, spend a lot more time with less content so you understand it better.
This is why it's so crucial that we have diversity in media. And by that, I mean a diverse cross-section of diversity, right? Not just one or two kinds of diversity, but trying to go across the spectrum and particularly going into and hearing from communities that have been marginalized, that do not have ready access to major platforms, certainly the corporate or traditional establishment media. This is what makes independent journalism and community-based journalism. And of course, here at the end, you've referred to, once again, the Society for Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, which I certainly encourage people to review, the SPJ Code of Ethics that we had talked about here earlier. Well, Nolan Higdon, I think you've demonstrated to us why democracy needs journalism and why we really need to read the news more critically. You've given us some ideas about how to do that, how to ask questions about it. Of course, your new book, The Anatomy of Fake News, A Critical News Literacy Education, also does that, as well as the recent documentary, The United States, A Distraction, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. So, Nolan Higdon, where can we find you online, and where can listeners either contact you or follow more of your work?
At @Nolan_Higdon on Twitter. That's where you can follow the majority of my work. And you can also follow our podcast, Along the Line, at youtube.com/Along the Line.
Nolan Higdon, thank you so much for joining us once again on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. From fake news, we go to academic freedom on America's college campuses. We'll have a new update from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education coming up next. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are going to be highlighting a new study from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the FIRE. You can learn more at thefire.org. I, of course, have had members of the FIRE on the program before to talk about free speech and academic freedom on campus. In fact, not long ago, I spoke with people at the FIRE because of the support for Banned Books Week. Today, we're looking at academic freedom and free speech on college campuses, a new study titled 2020 College Free Speech Rankings. What's the climate for free speech on America's college campuses? This study features opinions of the roughly 20,000 students surveyed by FIRE. It was a study also commissioned by College Pulse and Real Clear Education. We'll talk more about that in the interview here. I am delighted to welcome to the program Nico Perino. Nico Perino is the Vice President of Communications at the FIRE. He's also host of their podcast, So to Speak, the Free Speech Podcast. If you haven't heard that, you should definitely check that out at the FIRE website. Nico Perino, welcome to the Project Censor Show.
Mickey, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
What a time to be talking about these issues, free speech and academic freedom, free speech on campus. And of course, for people that don't know, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to defending and sustaining the individual rights of students and faculty members at America's colleges and universities. These rights include freedom of speech, freedom of association, due process, legal equality, religious liberty, and sanctity of conscience, the essential qualities of liberty. Again, you can learn more at thefire.org. So, Nico Perino, I know that the FIRE routinely does studies and has a rating system for free speech on campus. So could you talk to us, what exactly are you doing at the FIRE and relate it to these spotlights that you've been doing over the years?
For many years now, we've have what's called our spotlight rating system, where FIRE attorneys look at college policies or college speech codes at, I think now we're over 450 colleges, and rate those policies for their First Amendment compliance. That is at public colleges and universities that are bound by the First Amendment. At private universities, if those private universities promise free expression, then we also measure their policies against First Amendment standards. And we give them a green light rating if those policies don't infringe on any free speech rights, and a red light rating if they clearly do. And there's a yellow light rating if the policies are vague so that they could be interpreted by administrators to violate free speech rights. And we've been doing that for many years. We've been very successful in reforming a lot of these policies. We rate these policies as a way to kind of work with college administrations to bring their policies in line with the First Amendment. More recently, we've gotten into the survey business, where we've taken a look at college students. We've partnered with YouGov in the past to survey. Our past three surveys were about 2,500 college students nationally about their attitudes, not just on free speech, but on also other civil liberties issues such as due process. But this new survey that you mentioned is really the first of its kind for us, and really the first of its kind for anyone in the country. What we did is we surveyed 20,000 college students at 55 college campuses to try and gauge what the climate is for free speech on those campuses. And then what we did is we created an index to rate the colleges 1 through 55 on their free speech climates. And what we found was particularly fascinating. We did this to try and answer the question that we've been getting at FIRE since we were founded in 1999, which is, what are the best climates for free speech on campus? We can give them the spotlight rating that I mentioned before. We can tell them anecdotally what we've heard from people on the ground, but we've never systematically surveyed students about their own attitudes in a scientific manner about what the climates are on those campuses. And that's what we did here.
This is the new study just released, 2020 College Free Speech Rankings. What's the climate for free speech on America's college campuses? So, Nico Perino, tell us some more on the methodology for this particular study and maybe talk about how colleges were chosen and what some of these were.
Yeah, so I'll talk first about what colleges were chosen. So what we tried to do here was get a diversity of types of colleges. Geographically, we tried to find colleges all across the country. We tried to get a mix of private and public colleges. We tried to get a mix of small and large colleges. And we ended up with the list of 55 that we had. We were also limited in some senses by the panels that College Pulse had available. You needed to have a statistically significant enough number of students on those campuses in order for us to be able to pull them. So there were some campuses that we wanted to include that we just couldn't include because we didn't have the means to do it. And that's actually the reason this hasn't been done before, is you couldn't get access to a lot of these students on campuses without going through the universities themselves. And for obvious reasons, they're typically reluctant to do that. So we had the means to do that here. Now, the methodology, we asked 26 questions. We put those questions into categories. And the statisticians at College Pulse and here at FIRE determined how to weight the different categories to get the rank. So one of the categories is tolerance, which is the sum of responses to questions about allowing controversial speakers on campus. Another category is openness, like how confident did students feel and their ability to speak up on campus. One of the questions we asked them was, some students say it can be difficult to have conversations about certain issues on campus. Which of the following issues, if any, would you say are difficult to have an open and honest conversation about? We gave them topics like race, abortion, gun rights, feminism. And surprisingly, most students said the two most difficult things to discuss on campus, and maybe this is unsurprising, but the most difficult is abortion. And in a very, very close second is race. Now, I should caution that these surveys were conducted from early April to mid-May of this year, so before the George Floyd protests. I'm sure some of the questions that we have about race would come out a little bit differently after the events of this summer. So that was one category of questions. So tolerance of controversial speakers was 40% of the weight. Openness was 40. Then we had self-expression. We asked students about whether they ever self-censored themselves and why. That was 8% of the ranking. Administrative support was one. We asked students a series of questions about their administration. For example, does your college administration make it clear to students that free speech is protected on your campus? Would the college administration be more likely to protect the rights or abridge the rights of a controversial speaker? And then accounting for 4% of the weighting is also FIRE's speech code rating, because it's not just important to us how students feel on campus. It's also important to incorporate in some way the objective category there, which is the policies. Do they comport with First Amendment standards? So those are the various variables that went into the weighting itself. We had a couple of extra questions that were just added, not to go into the weightings, but just to add some color to the survey to get some interesting data points on tolerance. For example, we asked students who disapprove of Donald Trump whether they would be able to date a Trump supporter. We asked people who approve of Donald Trump whether they'd be able to date a Trump opponent. And some of the results there were fascinating as well. We found that 55% of people who disapprove of Donald Trump say it would be impossible or very difficult to date a Trump supporter. 11% of people who approve of Trump say it would be impossible or very difficult to date a Trump opponent. So some timely political questions there as well. And on the topic of controversial speakers, I should add, we found that nearly one-third of students in our sample don't think Trump should be allowed to speak on campus. 22% for Biden. Bernie had the highest support on campus. 87% of students thought he should be allowed to speak on campus, which of course means 13% said he did not. That's 1 in 10, still concerning. But some interesting, timely political findings there.
Before we dive into more of the nitty-gritty of the study itself and the findings, given that you've been with the fire for a while and you're familiar with the spotlight ratings, do you see a lot of the trends continue in the study, or did you see some things break away?
When we first got the results, we weren't surprised to see University of Chicago come in at number one overall. Mm-hmm. That was actually kind of a proof of concept for us, because as your listeners may be aware, University of Chicago has become a kind of leader in signaling support for free speech, open expression, and academic freedom. And their students clearly saw it that way as well. I mean, administrative support for free expression, according to students, was 91.6, which is far and away better than almost every other college. They're just way higher than other colleges on that. So it was good to see that some of the colleges that we thought anecdotally might be the best actually came back the best when the data came in. And some of the colleges that we have had problems with at FIRE for many, many years are near the bottom. Syracuse University is constantly on our list as being a problematic school for free expression. This despite the fact that their School of Communications has the First Amendment emblazoned on the front of the building. It's a private university, of course. They can choose different values, but you probably shouldn't put First Amendment in big, bold letters on your communication school if you're censoring left, right, and center. So they came in at 51 out of 55. Louisiana State University, which we at FIRE have sued in the past, came in at 53. And then coming in at the bottom of the list, the bottom 10, is Brigham Young University, which is a warning school in our spotlight rating system, which means that it's a private university. It places other values above free expression. It's, of course, a Mormon school. It came in dead last with liberal students and its free speech climate. So that's kind of a proof of concept as well. We at FIRE gives these sorts of schools a warning rating because it's their free association right to associate around other values besides free speech. But we just want them to be upfront and warn people about that. When I look anecdotally at what we've experienced in the past, not only with the spotlight rating, but also with cases, the good schools tend to come out at the top and the bad schools tend to come out at the bottom. Georgetown is also there at number 48 as well. We've had a number of issues with them. They've been on our worst colleges for free speech lists multiple times. So,
and again, there are some places on the list as far as the worst for free speech, according to your rating system, surprising to me somewhat. I mean, Dartmouth came as a surprise. And then, of course, the top five that you have for free speech, Chicago on the top, also surprising to me. I wouldn't necessarily think that Kansas State University would be one of these top five, or Texas A&M for that matter. So there's definitely some interesting findings in the study.
Well, one of the things we did find is that some of these bigger state schools performed better. And we're still trying to parse the data, but our suspicion is it's because they have greater ideological diversity on campus. But at the same time, we were concerned that schools were going to come out well in the rankings if they had an ideological monoculture. So, for example, if you are at a school where everyone thinks the same and you tend to think with the prevailing orthodoxy, then you're probably going to feel pretty good about the climate on your campus. And that's one of the situations that we kind of found at Brown. It's the only Ivy League in the top 10 in our rankings. But if you look at it from just liberal students, it performs well. It performs number 35th for conservative students. And that's why if you go to speech.collegepulse.com, we allow you to sort all these rankings and all the data by different variables. We did a rank by liberals and we did a rank by conservative just because we were concerned that ideological monocultures would be privileged in the study. Brown comes in dead last in ideological diversity. You know, of the respondents, 79% were liberal. Number one was Penn State, you know, another one of those big state schools. So
you in the surveys then allowed people to self-identify ideologically. Is that correct?
Well, College Pulse has a panel of students all across the country, 100,000 students. And yeah, as part of the becoming a part of the panel, you answer some demographic questions. Self-identify ideologically, self-identify politically. They ask, you know, what your race or ethnicity is, whether you're male or female. So yes, people self-identify in that way, correct?
Listeners to this show will know that we sometimes take issues with blanket labels like liberal or conservative because there's so much nuance and breadth between. But for the intents of your study here, do you find that they hold value? do you think that they seem to be a fairly accurate snapshot of what you were looking for?
I hope so. And I think that's borne out by actually looking at the rankings themselves. For example, it's no surprise that Brigham Young University performs the worst with liberals. It's no surprise that a school like Brown performs poorly with conservatives. So, yeah, I think they tend to bear out. And also, when you look at the ideological breakdown at certain schools, your initial impressions are usually right. The bigger state schools have greater ideological diversity than some of the private schools, especially in the Northeast. So it passes the smell test, I would hope.
I'd like to remind listeners that you are tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Nico Perino. He's the Vice President of Communications for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the FIRE. He's also host of, so to speak, the Free Speech Podcast. We're talking about a new comprehensive report from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the 2020 College Free Speech Rankings. What's the climate for free speech on America's college campuses? After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Nico Perino. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In the segment of the program today, we are joined by Nico Perino. He is the Vice President of Communications for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, thefire.org. We're talking right now about a very new report that has just come out that was done earlier this year that took a look at free speech on college campuses. The study, 2020 College Free Speech Rankings. What's the climate for free speech on America's college campuses? Nico Perino, you were breaking things down for us. And so what we want to do is get into some more details about what the findings were. But before I do that, I also want to address one other issue. I have worked with you all at The FIRE before in various ways. Project Censored has featured The FIRE in our Media Democracy in Action chapter in our annual books with Will Creeley and others. It is the case, of course, that while The FIRE itself is a very interesting mix of very different people ideologically inside, one of the things that we have been asked about here at Project Censored in terms of our support of what The FIRE does is those that are more media literate or savvy in research will say, hey, well, isn't The FIRE funded by the Koch brothers? This new study that you're looking at, it's College Pulse, The FIRE, but it's also Real Clear Education, which is connected to the Real Clear Foundation, which is a conservative foundation. How do you think that influences what you all were asking or doing in the study? And how would you respond to people that would show some concern for that kind of backing?
I will say it has nothing to do with the rankings or the how we asked questions. I was involved in that process. Personally, I am not conservative. I've never considered myself conservative. And if FIRE were a conservative organization, I wouldn't be working at FIRE. FIRE brings in people from across the political ideological spectrum. If I had to guess our staff's politics, I'd suspect most people are liberal. But we were involved in the rankings. There was no undue influence in this. FIRE, like many civil libertarian organizations, works with all to do good and none to do harm. And Real Clear has covered these issues before. The reason we partnered with them is because they are one of the leading polling companies in the country. The Real Clear polls for presidential elections or for midterm elections is what's cited by other media groups often to try and figure out who's leading in the polls. And so we wanted a good, literate media partner involved in the polling project, and one that also could generate some coverage for the project. So when we're defending the animal rights group in Missouri, we're accused of being left-wing. When we're defending the Turning Point USA group in New York State, we're accused of being right-wing. And it's something you just kind of get when you do this civil libertarian work across the political and ideological spectrum. I think it'd be easier for people if they could pigeon us as being right-wing or left-wing or libertarian. But it's not something we do, and it's something that, unfortunately, we've become accustomed to in our increasingly isolated political culture where political division is just kind of taken for granted.
very hyper-partisan climate, right? And I mean, at Project Censored, we've had similar experiences. Your response, of course, fair enough. And Project Censored is an anti-censorship organization. So sometimes we say things that are unpopular to various people, and we say, well, that's why we don't support censorship. We're a pro-free speech organization ourselves.
Individuals across the political spectrum should support free speech principles, because censorship has a way of, today it might be the left wing being censored, but tomorrow it might be the right wing, and we at FIRE have no political litmus test for our supporters.
That's, again, refreshing, and I wish that more people would find it so and maybe emulate those kinds of principled stands, particularly when it comes to free speech and opposing censorship. So that leads us back to the study. I urge people to go to thefire.org, read the study. You can download the study for free, and you can read it yourself. You mentioned earlier, Nico Perino, that one of the top contentious issues where there were concerns about expression and censorship was race on campus. And that you did say that this was finished. This study was actually conducted before the George Floyd protests. But the trend is already there and established, it seems like, that this was a very contentious issue around race. Can you share maybe some of the stats and some of the experiences that people are talking about on campuses when it comes to free speech around racial issues?
Well, let me just preface by explaining the questions. We told students, some students say it can be difficult to have conversations about certain issues on campus. Which of the following issues, if any, would you say are difficult to have an open and honest conversation on your campus about? We asked about 8 or 9 issues. Coming in at number one, and students could choose all the issues, they could select all the issues that they thought were difficult to have an open and honest conversation about. Coming in at number one at 45% was abortion. But just beneath that was race at 43%, 41% was gun control, transgender issues was 40%, and then the fewest respondents selected feminism as being a difficult issue to have a conversation about at 29%. I should note that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is particularly hot at Northeast, West Coast, and at Ivy League schools. It seems to be kind of an elite school issue that's difficult to have open and honest conversations about. But race was a tremendously difficult conversation for a lot of people to have, and especially for Black students. We found that 66%, if I'm remembering that correctly, Black Yes. students saw that as being a difficult conversation to have on their campus.
So, Nico Perino, what are the prescriptions, if any, that you might take from this new study? And do you think that this could be used by campuses to maybe improve the culture of free speech on those respective campuses?
I certainly hope that college administrations will look at these rankings and reach out to us with that same question that you're asking me right now. What are some of the prescriptions? Well, one of the obvious prescriptions is to change your speech codes. That's within every university's power. It's required by law with public universities to make sure your policies comport with the First Amendment. So that's a very easy one. And as I mentioned, that accounts for 4% of the ranking. The other one is just be vocal in support of free expression and support of academic freedom. But also, if there's a controversy, support the beleaguered faculty member, the beleaguered student, where there's calls for their censorship, and do it quick and do it fast. And we've seen that at a number of colleges where the university administration has come out quickly in defense of the rights of the speaker. They send a strong message to the community.
Well, Nico Perino, the study ends by saying, this report and subsequent papers will add tens of thousands of student voices and experiences to the discussion on free expression on America's college campuses. And given all of our focus on college campuses, I'm a professor, of course, the student-centered approach is certainly one that we always need to be mindful of, and we really need to have that at the center of our educational experience. And so it looks like this report is giving us a really unique look at what's going on with student voices and their experiences about free expression on campuses. So Nico Perino, Vice President of Communication at The FIRE, that's thefire.org, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And I just became aware that you have a new documentary film coming out.
The documentary is called Mighty Ira. You can learn more about it at mightyira.com, but it's about Ira Glasser, who ran the American Civil Liberties Union from 1978 to 2001. He took over the Civil Liberties Union as executive director just in the wake of the Skokie case, which I suspect a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. But before that, he was working as the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union and was very involved in defending the ACLU's position in the Skokie case. It's really a look at Ira Glasser's life. He is a guy who grew up in Brooklyn, saw Jackie Robinson break the color barrier, was convinced to take his first job at the ACLU by Bobby Kennedy, of all people. He got a meeting with Bobby Kennedy in his senator's office, and Then we look at the Skokie case. It's kind of the through line up through Charlottesville and IRA's positions on Charlottesville. But the film is also looking at, you know, what it means to talk across lines of difference. IRA was good friends, if not best friends, with William F. Buckley, a conservative paragon on the other side of the aisle, kind of reminds you of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's friendship with Antonin Scalia. And in this film, we also feature a conversation, a first ever meeting between IRA and a 99-year-old Holocaust survivor named Ben Stern. IRA flew over to Berkeley, and he and Ben had a conversation about what Skokie meant to Ben. Ben was then a resident of Skokie and was the leader of the opposition to the neo-Nazis marching in that community. And it's very heartwarming what you see at the end as the outcome of that conversation. But the film is really about what it means to be a free speech civil libertarian. IRA and those of his generation, sadly, are retiring from the barricades. In the case of people like Nat Hentoff or Norman Dorson, dying off. And the neutral principles that throughout their careers they defended, I feel, are being ceded to the politics of expediency. What is good for my side right now, rather than what is good for my side or all Americans in the long term, which is really what free speech is about. If you censor this group now, as IRA says in the documentary, censorship is like poison gas. It might work well for you in the short term when the winds are blowing in your direction, but the winds have a tendency to shift and you can be caught with censorship on the other end. So I really hope your listeners will check it out. It's premiering with Angelica Film Center, streaming online starting October 9th. It'll be available on Amazon, Google, and iTunes starting October 23rd and Blu-ray and DVD at the same time. And you can get all the updates and register for the email list at mightyira.com. That's MIGHTYIRA.com.
Nico Perino, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I know you've been working on this project for the last couple of years. Very excited to see this film. And thank you for joining us today to talk about the FIRE's new study, 2020 College Free Speech Rankings. What's the climate for free speech on America's college campuses? Learn more at thefire.org. Nico Perino, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thanks again for having me.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear this.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. In the times where the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.